Boker Tov, everybody. Chodesh Tov to everybody. It's nice to see everybody, although still holiday season, it's nice that people can get out and about, come to a shir. But of course, the holiday season is drawing to a close. We're already in Chodesh Elul, and looking forward now to a whole series of exciting Elul, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. And some people may even be looking forward to Simchat Torah and thinking to themselves, planning already what they're going to have to drink on Simchat Torah. I don't know, maybe people do or don't do that. Maybe there are other things to think about during Elul than that. But today's shir deals with what would seem at first sight to be a very straightforward issue, but actually turns into a highly complicated but very interesting kashrus conundrum, which is the question of sherry cask whiskey. Meaning whiskey which has been matured in sherry casks, which there's a lot of this on the market now. You go to any shul, any kiddush and shul, you'll see this is being served in many places. I'd like to get into the dynamics of this, and we'll see. As I said, it's highly complicated. If you haven't already had a whiskey this morning, you'll need one by the end of the shir. And if you don't need one, I'll need one. So let's see how we get on. Actually, not so many makorot today, not that many sources, but we need to keep our heads clear to understand the material. Let's start with a quote from an unusual source, which is scotchwhiskey.com. Not one that I've brought on a source sheet before. Why age whiskey in sherry casks? So look at what they say here. Sherry casks have been used to age Scotch whiskey for well over 200 years. But what are the distillers looking for when choosing casks, and how are they able to produce specific flavors? A distiller wants a cask to contribute flavor to the maturing whiskey. Vanilla, coconut, spice, chocolate from American oaks, tannin, resin, clove, and dried fruits from European oaks. So in sherry rind production, the flavors are driven by oxidation rather than oak, meaning the sherry is more interested in the monitoring than the oxidation, while in the whiskey maturation process, it's the other way around. It seems to be the wood that they're interested in. All of this might seem as if it's the oak which is the main driver in terms of flavor of the sherried whiskey. This is not quite true either. What happens during the seasoning process is that the sherry modifies the flavor compounds in the oak. It is estimated that there's up to 10 liters of sherry soaked into the wood of a sherry butt, that's a sherry cask. To see whether it's the oak or the sherry that gives the sherried flavor to a scotch, scientists simply added sherry, real sherry, into scotch to see whether the combination was the same as maturing in a sherry butt. It wasn't. You can't just pour sherry into regular whiskey and it tastes the same. It doesn't. Equally, aging in an untreated European oak butt gives a different result. So it's not the sherry, and it's not the wood. It seems to be the combination of the two together. The sherry character, therefore, is down to the sherry itself, but also oxidation and the way that the sherry has interacted with and changed compounds in the oak. All of these interact over time with the maturing spirit. Now, you can see already that they're themselves in a bit of a dilemma. Is it the sherry? Is it the oak? Is it both? It seems to be both. This for us is going to become quite an important factor, but I wanted to bring you that at the beginning. What are the halakhic issues? Well, there are many. The issue of sherry cask whiskey raises at least 10 major halakhic principles in Hilchos Kashrus. So this is going to be for us today a very interesting chazara, a good review of many important principles in kashrus that apply beyond this, but certainly also in this. We're going to talk about noisein tam, something that gives out taste, and whether that's lishvach, positive taste, or lifgam, negative taste. We're going to talk about a ben yomo and an eino ben yomo. As everybody knows, there's a difference between using a pot which is more than 24 hours since it was last used or less. What about after 12 months? Does that change the kashrus status? What is the difference between tam, taste, and reicha, reyach, which is aroma? Is it aroma that they're looking for in the sherry, or is it taste? A zev, a zeh gorim, which is a halachic principle, we'll see where there are contributing factors to something that becomes questionably kosher. Which of them do we go with? Bittel, this will be a big issue. Bittel b'shishim, bittel b'sheish, we'll see how that works. kovush, which is where something is rather than being boiled or cooked. Most of our kashrus questions come up when things have been cooked in the wrong pot. I cooked my meat in my milchik pot. This is, no one's cooking anything here. This is kavush. Kavush means it's pickling, but here means long-term storage in the same pot. Chanan, which is a principle which stands for chaticha na'aseh nevela. We'll see what that means later. Bittel isla chapchila, where people intentionally put something trace into a compound to make it bafel. We'll see what that means later. And also chazuta kala. All of these and more we will have to talk about over the next few minutes. So let's start. Let's talk a little bit first about scotch. What are the ingredients in scotch whiskey? Well, at first sight, it seems to be an open and shut case. The only ingredients which they may, by law, be put into Scotch whiskey are three. Barley, which is obviously kosher. Barley, water, and yeast. All of those three ingredients are completely unproblematic in terms of kashrus. Also, occasionally they add caramel coloring, that's also not a problem. How do we know they're not secretly popping in other ingredients that we don't know about? The answer is because they are not allowed to do so by law. There is a statutory instrument in UK legislation, I gave you the reference at the bottom in case you're interested in looking it up, which says to them they are not allowed to put any more than these three or maybe four ingredients in. And if they do, they will obviously be in big trouble and lose their license. And the halachic principle of mirtat will apply, that if we know that they'd be very scared if people found out that they added stuff in, then we don't have to worry they're going to do that. They've got more to lose than anybody else, and therefore we're not worried they're putting anything else in. So it seems that whiskey is not a problem. What could be wrong with whiskey? Well, this question didn't just come up in the last few years. 70 years ago, a rabbi who many of you probably have heard of, and some of you maybe even knew, called Rabbi Pinchas Teitz. Rabbi Pinchas Teitz, who was a Talmud Chacham, who was a Rav in Elizabeth, New Jersey, in the 1940s, he discovered that in American whiskey, and by the way, what I said to you just before about the ingredients being only three ingredients is only true of Scotch. Once you're dealing with other countries and other whiskeys, Irish whiskey, Canadian whiskey, American whiskey, they're not bound by these rules, and therefore they have different kashrus considerations, and you can't guarantee what they say about Scotch. But Rabbi Teitz discovered in America that they were putting actual wine into the whiskey. And since the content of the wine in the whiskey was quite small, it was 2.5%, it was a 40th or less, they didn't have to put that on the label. They didn't have to disclose that. That was de minimis. The American regulations were not concerned about that. However, said Rav Teitz, we are concerned about that because if we need bittel b'shishim, shishim is 1.67%. It's much less than 2.5%, and therefore he was very concerned. And he wrote a shaila to Rav Moshe Feinstein. What are we going to do about this whiskey? People are drinking this whiskey, frumi yidden are drinking this whiskey, and it's got wine in it. Wine, obviously, is not kosher for reasons that we'll see why exactly wine isn't kosher. Rav Moshe wrote him a tshuva back, and I referenced the tshuva there. We're going to see a little bit now from the tshuva. He wrote him the tshuva and said, it's fine, it's not a problem, and he gives a long, complicated analysis of why that's fine. Rabbi Teitz was not to be deterred, and he wrote back to Rav Moshe. But what, he was a big Talmud Chacham, and what about this, and what about that, and what about this? Rav Moshe wrote him a second tshuva and said, it's fine, all your questions are good questions, but it's okay because of this and this. And he wrote him a third shaila, and Rav Moshe wrote him a third tshuva, and now there are three tshuvas in the Igros Moshe, which date between March, April, May 1948. Interesting, May 1948 was a busy month for the Jewish people, but it was also a month where we were dealing with this question of, this wasn't Scotch whiskey, and this wasn't sherry cask, but this was actually wine in the whiskey. Have a look here at what Rav Moshe says in number two. I like this little extract for a few reasons which we'll see. Kibelti michtava yakar b'davar hayesh. Yesh is whiskey, yain saraf, that's the word in Hebrew for whiskey. I received your letter about yesh blended. This is blended here in Hebrew, in English. In the Hebrew, English and Hebrew letters. I've received your question about blended whiskey. Shetachat hashkachata osim blended, and I see that you've now under hashkacha made blended whiskey shelobata rovis yain, the glycerin, without any problems of wine and glycerin. The ani oimelai, I want to say to this man, yasha kaichai. That's a good thing to do, bazaar. Sheyihi yera'ui, because it's only appropriate, lemahadrin, for a mahadrin, hashali, izami, dvarim shetarech horat chacham. If people want to be careful, they should They should avoid questionable mixtures like this. The ani, and I for myself, says Rav Moshe, actually ani matir, even though I allow, actually, and he goes on to explain why, which we'll see some of his reasoning, I allow the whiskey even with the wine in it. I don't need the hechshed whiskey in principle. Nizhar ani ba'atzmi milishdot blended. I actually am careful, I am personally machmir, that I don't drink the whiskey with the wine in it, even though I think it is kosher. Rak b'chabura. Only if I'm in a social setting, says Rav Moshe, Shaloyla mechti kiyura, I don't want to appear over frum or arrogant, Hayiti shotem mashu, I of course will drink the whiskey, even the blended whiskey, Levarech hamutzubin, to give a bracha to the hosts and to the guests, Kenahug, as is appropriate. Meaning Rav Moshe is pains to say, don't think that I'm telling you this whiskey's trafe, and I generally don't drink it, but of course I wouldn't want to appear too frum. Rav Moshe Feinstein wouldn't want to appear too frum. So he says, I don't want to appear, this might be arrogance if I don't drink the whiskey, so of course I will drink it in a crowd, but I'm generally machmi. Or lechein zavai tov shiyeh hayesh blended below shum chashash, I definitely think this should be whiskey without any of this problem, and I think you're doing a good job. Aval ledina hayesh blended asher yesh chashash shema ma'arvim b'chelek echad me'arvim yayin mutzav shtiyah. But according to the din, I actually hold this wine, even with the whiskey in it, with a danger of whiskey, of wine in it, this whiskey is kosher. V'zeu ledina, this is the halacha, aval bal nefesh, someone who's a bal nefesh, meaning they want to be machmir, they want to take on a chumrah, we'll see it's an appropriate chumrah. Bal nefesh yesho lahachmir, should be machmir, al atzmo, mitzad kama chashashot. Because there are concerns. Don't get me wrong, he says, there are concerns. This is talking about whiskey with wine added in. That is not today the problem that we're dealing with, but we'll see many of his issues apply. We are dealing with today whiskey from wine cask barrels, sherry barrels. Now, what's going to be worse? Taste of the sherry in the barrels, is that more of a problem or less of a problem than wine actually added into the mixture? So you would have thought, well, it's less of a problem because wine in real terms added in must be more halakhically problematic. And we'll see actually that's not the case. It may be that the problem with the sherry cask whiskey is more significant than the problem that Rav Moshe is dealing with for reasons that will become clear. Over the last few decades, this has been more of an issue because more of this wine is on the market and more of it's on the Jewish market. I'm sure people are familiar here with their scotches, whether it's the Macallan or Glenmorangie or Lagavulin or Lafroig or Talisker or all of these. I don't know anything about whiskey, no. but people are probably. I actually went a few years ago with my son to Scotland. I thought we'd never been to Scotland before, and we went on a hiking round the Isle of Skye and whiskey distillery tour. So we learned quite a lot about whiskey distilleries at that point, and some of that comes in here. Rabbi Akiva Niehaus in Chicago actually wrote up a fantastic, comprehensive 118-page pamphlet, if you can still call it a pamphlet, a book on this, which I put in the further reading at the end, and he concludes, and we'll see why, that the pure 100% sherry cask whiskies should be avoided. He doesn't say they're trace, because we'll see there are poskim that say they're kosher, but he says they should be avoided. He's happier with the blended malts, even if they're single malts, which well, they can't be single if they're blended, but the whiskies that are mixed in different ways, he's happier with that, but he says that the sherry ones should be avoided. Why did he come to this conclusion? Well, first of all, why do they use sherry cask in the first place? Historically, very interestingly, the origin of this is as follows. A couple of hundred years ago, Scottish whiskey makers found that there were a lot of cheap sherry casks knocking around Scotland because they exported sherry from Spain and from Portugal in casks. And there's nothing to do with the casks. At the end, they were shipped, they emptied the casks, and they were all hanging around. So they said, you know, we'll use these. So they used those, and it was very nice. In the 1970s, after General Franco died in Spain, and they restored democracy, they changed and they shook up a few things, and they decided, hey, we're missing a trick here. We don't need to send barrels of sherry overseas. We can bottle it in Portugal and Spain, and we can sell it for more money if we bottle it here. So they stopped sending out the sherry in casks. So the Scottish whiskey makers ran out of sherry casks. So they said, you know, no, never mind, we'll use another cask. And they went to America, and they used bourbon casks. From Kentucky, okay, and from Tennessee. And they used those for a few years. Now, apparently by American law, with bourbon, you can only use the cask new. You can't use the used cask. There are a lot of those casks on the market. So they said, fine, Loich Patlan, we'll use those. People started to complain. Once that whiskey came on the market, 12 years later, they started to complain. The whiskey changed. It don't taste like what it used to. What's going on with our whiskey? And they realized, aha, we're missing something here. What's happened to the whiskey? Must be the sherry cask. So they realized they need sherry casks, and of course now they were very expensive. They have to bring them specially from Spain, just the casks. And that's why the cost of sherry whiskey, sherry cask whiskey went through the roof. People of course will pay for this, but now they've realized that it is the sherry casks that make the difference, and therefore they import them and they use them specifically. What now is our halachic issue with these sherry casks? So let's have a look, first of all, at the general halacha of using, if you like, blended drinks. First of all, you have to be aware that non-Jewish wine, as I'm sure you know, is not kosher. Why is non-Jewish wine made by non-Jews, why is that not kosher? So if it originally was used for some kind of avodah zarah, some kind of idolatrous purpose, then that is an isur min haTorah. That is a Torah prohibition. The wine may not be drunk. It may not have any benefit gained from it. It is absolutely prohibited. However, Chazal extended that, and they made a second, the first one was min haTorah, but on a rabbinic level, they said that wine, even if it's what they called stam yenam is wine, regular wine made by non-Jewish people, which has got nothing to do with avodah zarah. You go into a wine shop now in London, in New York, there's no wine which is avodah zarah wine. If you want to buy communion wine from the church, then that's a whole different question about whether Christianity is avodah zarah. That we dealt with, if you remember, last November, December. Not dealt with, but we raised that question. But regular wine is stam yenam. Stam yenam, say Chazal, you shouldn't drink it. It is an issur derabbanon, and that's going to be very important in the shir. It's a rabbinic issur to drink. Why? There's nothing to do with idolatry. What's the problem? Chazal said, because the people you drink with are the people you form relationships with, and the people you form relationships with are the people that you marry. And as far as I can see, that's still how it works today. And intermarriage, obviously, is a very major issue, today more than ever. And Chazal said, therefore, you cannot drink wine together with non-Jewish people if the wine was made by the non-Jews. Fine. So non-Jewish made wine is an issur derabbanan. Whether you're allowed to get benefit from it or not is a good question. There are different poskim that say different things. Many, many years ago in London when I was a lawyer, actually a very junior lawyer, I spotted something a little bit strange in a contract I was dealing with, which seemed to indicate that the client we were acting for was entitled to around £1 million more money than he thought he was. It couldn't possibly be correct. How could I spot this when people haven't spotted this? But I asked my colleagues and they said, oh yeah, that could be, you could be. And we made a case for it and eventually he got the extra money. Obviously he was over the moon and he sent me this extremely expensive case worth $4,000 or $5,000 of wine, of champagne from who knows where, 12 bottles of amazingly expensive champagne, of course with none of which I could drink. So I asked Shaila, do I have to just pour it all down the bathroom, you know, sink, or can I sell it to someone? Am I allowed to have benefit from this stam yena? And the answer I got, thankfully, was that I was allowed to sell it, and in fact I sold it to my colleagues and I bought with it some rather nice Scotch whiskey, as it happens. But I'm not telling you what kind until the end of the shift. So wine, you're not allowed to drink wine, and benefit from stam yenam is a question, but many poskim are makel. However, when they add the wine to other drinks, what is the situation? Look at source number 3. Kol ha-mashkim shel oivde kochavim. Any drinks made by non-Jews, shedarchem la'ariz v'hem yayin or chametz, where it's often the case that they will add in wine or vinegar, which is made from wine, asurim. If they add in wine on a regular basis, you have to be worried that they may have added in wine here and you can't drink it. Says the Ramah, v'chol zeh b'mashkim sh'ayayin v'achometz hu b'hem l'shvach. But that's only where the wine taste that they're adding in is improving the drink. Or sharing a pogam, or at least it's neutral. Aval im hu lifgam, but if ultimately the taste of the wine is negative, kagoin, for example, seva. Let's say they add the wine in just as a coloring. Shenatu behem chomet, they put vinegar, or melach. Shemavashlin oivikachan, venotin bo yayin. Or they put wine in, or dam, or blood in the labno to bleach it, whatever. Mutara, then it's fine. The chol zehayu lifgam. That is all notein tam lifgam. that is all a taste which itself is a negative taste, and even if it gets mixed in, you don't have to worry about it. That's the first principle. Noisen tam lifgam is not a problem. We once had an interesting shaila back in the day. My wife poured a pack of beans from the freezer into a pan and cooked them up. And she just poured it in. She didn't look at it. And she poured the frozen beans from the freezer. And she put it in. She came over to the pan. I heard a scream. I can still remember the scream right now. There was a snail in the pan. It obviously somehow got into the packaging of the beans. There was a snail sitting there cooking in escargot. You know, it's a new dish. And it was in the pan. So, of course, she threw the beans out. She's not going to eat the beans. The shaila is there anything wrong with the pan? Have we traced up our pan? Snails are not kosher. And the answer is no, we haven't traced up the pan. That's no sin tam lifgam. It's a horrible taste, it's not a good taste, and therefore whatever taste it gives off does not do anything. Probably we could have eaten the beans as well, but that's not something we were interested in doing. We're not that desperate for some frozen beans. And certainly the pan was fine. So comes along the Ramon, the Shulchan Aruch, and says that if they're adding in taste, but the taste is bad taste, it's not a problem. Now, is the sherry cask taste, whatever that taste is, good taste or bad taste? Well, they think it's good taste. Because you see the whole analysis on this, and if you read the tasting notes on the whiskey, you'll see all sorts of, you know, when they talk about the blueberry and lemongrass hints and aromas and all that. They often say, and hints of sherry, which enhance, etc., etc. So they obviously think it's a positive taste. And therefore, we can't just get away with saying that it's a bad taste. That's something which we'll have to accept is probably whatever the taste is and wherever it comes from, it's a good taste. The question is, if they're putting it in there specifically to taste, is that a problem? Let's go to page 3 and have a look on this. So the Shulchan Aruch actually raises the issue of barrels. Can we reuse barrels used by non-Jews for their own wine? Which seems to be our case. Look at number 4. Kelim ha'asurim machmas yayin shel ovdei kochavim. Barrels, kelim, which are now prohibited because there's wine in them, which has been made by non-Jews. Mutalit letocham, you can now reuse them. Bein mayim, whether for water. Bein sheichar, whether for beer. Bein shar mashkim, or for other drinks. Bilvad sheyadich mitchila, you just need to give them a good wash out. Lichluchei hayayin, to make sure there's no dregs or sediments of the wine, she'al pnei hakelim. So just make sure there's no wine left over. But you can reuse the barrels. As long as you don't reuse them for wine. Look in number 5, says the Taz. Nirali pashut. It seems obvious to me. Afilu im amashkim nishtayim sham le'et le'et. Even if the sherry had been in there for a long time, we'll see its kavush. Also, nevertheless, the barrel is fine. Dehatur kasav hatam kivin shehayayin pogemota. Because the taste of the wine will make whatever liquid you're putting in bad. So if you put in beer, if you put in water, then the old taste of the sherry will just make your drink taste worse, and therefore the Shulchan Aruch is not worried about it. Again, he says it's no sin tam lifgam. If you want to put wine in there, then you can't, because the wine taste will enhance your new wine, but it will not enhance your new beer or your new water. So what's with whiskey? So he seems to say, any other drink apart from wine, you can reuse the barrel. So it seems to be an open and shut case. Whiskey, we're not worried about. He just paskin that any other wine, any other drink in the barrel apart from wine, you can reuse the barrel. Unfortunately, it's not that straightforward. Because the Magen Avraham explicitly says, yes, that's true of beer. That's true of water. But whiskey, he says, everybody knows that whiskey tastes nicer with a bit of sherry taste in it. Interestingly, 400 years ago, people who think this is a new problem, they've just invented a new chumrah, that's not true at all. This is a very, very old problem. Look at what he says in number 6. He's here talking about chometz. He's talking about reusing beer barrels and things like that for Pesach. He's not talking about kashrus in a general sense. Look at number 6 what he says. The Torah Zabayit, he says here, Gabi Yayin, afilu haya hakli ben yomo. Even if the vessel hasn't been used for more than 24 hours, it has been used within 24 hours, shari, it's fine. The sheikhar b'yayin loisin tam lifgam. We see that beer and wine don't mix. They make a very bad taste. Kamasha k'zuv b'yoredeya, avaba meidvash. But there are other drinks, like meidvash, some kind of honey drink. Loi havelifgam. Maybe it's not so bad the taste of wine in that. Lachein im haya kli ben yomo, and therefore if it's a recently used kli, afilu kaidem pesach asurim loi haya shishim neged achometz. He's saying there are drinks where maybe the wine taste will improve. Umashma says the Magen Avraham. It seems from this shechavit shel yesh. Oh, here we see whiskey. Here he's dealing with the other way around. He's dealing with whiskey barrels being reused on Pesach for wine. Whiskey, of course, is chometz. And therefore, he's worried about the other way around. He says, but the whiskey and the wine, afal pisha'ena ben yomo, even though it may not have been used for the whiskey for a while, asura kol, that's not allowed. Why? De'einenu ro'os, that our eyes see, shenoisen tam lishvach hu. That whiskey and wine, everybody knows. Beer and wine, yuck, no good. Water and wine, nope, that's no good. But whiskey and wine, that's something. And therefore, I'm afraid we're not going to be able to get away with saying that the taste of wine, of the sherry, is no sin tam lifgam. If there is a taster there, it's going to be a good taste, not a bad taste. So how are we going to deal with this issue? Now, let's go on. Next principle. Eino ben yomo. Don't we know that if you haven't used a pot for 24 hours, then, okay, you can't use it lechatchila, you can't just pick up a fleishik pot that you haven't used for a week and cook up a milk dish in it, but b'di'eved, what's the halacha? Does it ruin the food, b'di'eved? No, it does not. That's the clear halacha everybody knows. If it's more than 24 hours since you used the pot for the other thing, it's not going to be b'di'eved, it's not going to be a problem. Oh, so again, so what's the problem? How long is it when we put the whiskey in the barrels? How long is it since they were used for sherry? Months. Possibly even years. We'll see, if it's years, it's maybe less of a problem. That's not going to help us either. Look at number 7. Ein chiluk bein kelim asurim mishum yayin nesach, bein shehem b'nei yoimam olo. There is no difference, says the Ramon Shulchan Aruch, when it comes to wine, when it comes to things which we use for wine, we don't apply the 24-hour rule. It's not the same. What's the difference? Why is it different between my fleishiks and milchiks? Why is wine any different? Says the Shach at the end of source 7. Da'afilo eino ben yom, even if they haven't been used for 24 hours, asurim, they still impart taste. The loy shayach noisin talif gam, ela betashil, because this idea that over 24 hours the taste goes off is with the food, is with the dish you cooked last week. Avaloy beklei ayayin, da'adarabba, on the contrary, kol shem yityashnim noisin talishvach. Everybody knows that the older wine gets, the better it gets, although that's not true of all wine, of course, but often the older wine gets, the better it gets. So even if you can say that the fleishik taste left in your fleishik pot after 24 hours is halachically less relevant, I'm afraid that the wine taste left in the wine barrels, the longer it's there, the better it gets. And therefore that's not going to help us either. All the nice things we usually rely on are not going to help us so far with the sherry casks. But what about more than 12 months? If it's really more than 12 months since it was used, maybe that's different. Look at number 8. Karl Akalim says the Shulchan Aruch, Shiyeshnam Yud Bet Chodesh. If it's been 12 months, shari, then that's fine. We don't have to worry. Whatever's left after 12 months, it's certainly not halachically relevant. Shebevadai Kala Kolich Luchit Hayayin. After 12 months, there's Gornish left. Shebehem Va'afilu Natan Latoch Al Mayim. Even if you put water and you reuse them, Latoch Yud Bet Chodesh within the 12 months, Ein Bekach Klum. Therefore, if we know that the sherry barrel has not been used for 12 months or more, then we'll be okay. How long does it take them to ship the sherry barrels from Spain or Portugal to Scotland? Can we say it's more than 12 months? Well, unfortunately, we cannot say that. It takes a matter of months, sometimes even a matter of weeks. People have very quick turnarounds these days, and what actually makes life even more problematical is that even though the casks are empty, they purposely put a little bit of sherry in them when they're shipping them, because they found that when they ship them, they crack, so they put sherry into them to slosh around the cask while it's on the boat to Scotland. So unfortunately, the 12-month rule is not going to help us either. So far, it's not looking too good for our sherry cask whiskey. There is. And one of the solutions which they make is they can make kosher sherry in Spain or Portugal, and they can use those casks. But that's going to be very expensive. And there's no reason to believe that the kosher sherry taste will be worse than the regular sherry taste, but it's going to be a very small run, and it's going to be a very select type. Yes?
There's a claim that I read that often talking has the best in that because It uses Carmel wine casks in Spain.
There you are.
I can't guarantee.
You heard the rumor here. There are whiskies we'll see that do have a hechsher. We'll get to them in a minute. And one of the reasons they might have a hechsher, as we hear here, is because they may be using wine barrels that were used for kosher sherry. So that is a possibility. And if you want your Ochem Toshen, you can check that on the website and see if that's true. I might be pronouncing it wrong. If there's anybody Scottish here or that might be listening to this shiur at some point in the future on the web, I apologize in advance. Now, taste. Is it really taste? What is, and we saw this at the very beginning, what is in the walls of these sherry casks? Look at number 9. Here we see an interesting conversation that Rabbi Niehaus, I mentioned before, had with Rav Shlomo Miller. Rav Shlomo Miller is a very senior posek in Canada. In a conversation with Rav Shlomo Miller, Shlita, he suggested that it's quite possible that the flavor contributed by the wine does indeed ruin the scotch. Maybe that it is harmless gum, just like wine ruins beer, as we've just seen, as indicated by the Gemara's allowance to store beer in a non-kosher wine barrel. Nevertheless, it is possible that the scotch distiller specifically used wine barrels to allow the scotch to absorb the wine's fragrance. And according to Halacha, fragrance added by a non-kosher ingredient is insignificant. We're not worried about fragrance. Reicha lav milsa. Accordingly, the non-kosher wine bleers would not require nullification. Can we get around this problem by saying, these Scottish whiskey tasters, they say that they're tasting sherry taste, but they're not. They're really tasting fragrance, which is not a halachic problem. This theory, however, he says, appears to be at odds with numerous experts who claim that sherry casks import a positive taste, not just fragrance. Rav Miller counted in a follow-up letter that even taste stems from fragrance. This is proved by the fact that someone with a cold or who is unable to smell has difficulty tasting food. Accordingly, the experts are merely experiencing fragrance, which is negligible in halacha. Can we just write off the problem and say it's not taste at all, it's just aroma? And this raises the interesting borderline between taste and fragrance and what's really coming out of this whiskey, or the sherry casks. The Rav Osher Weiss, who is a very senior posek in Yerushalayim, who we'll see later on in the shiur what his opinion is, he says that actually what's coming out of the whiskey, of the wine barrels is just a chemical. It's a mixture, a compound of the oak and the tannins and the wine. It's not tam at all, which is a little bit like what Shlomo Miller is saying. It's something else. It's not tam. So maybe we could say this, but maybe we can't. Certainly the Scottish tasters don't think that. We'll see if their opinion is relevant here. One last point before we get into the main issue is the thing I mentioned before, zev zegorim. What is zev zegorim? So let's go to cheese making. Number 10. Let's look at cheese. Im hamid gvina ba'or kibat nevela v'treifo behema tameya. How do you make cheese? You put milk and the curds and the whey, you put them into a stomach of a cow. And the rennet in the stomach of the cow acts on the milk product and it turns it, curdles it and turns it into cheese. What if you made cheese in a non-kosher stomach from a treifa, an animal that was sick and turns out to be treif, an animal which was nevela, which wasn't shechted, or a treifa animal. You put it in a donkey stomach. I don't know if donkey stomachs work for cheese making. What if you did that? Asur b'kol shehu, completely prohibited. That's absolutely treif, says the Shulchan Aruch. Mishum the davar ha'asur ba'atzma u'malmid, because even though you can't spot, you can't taste the taste of the meat that came out of the cow's stomach, it's what's called a malmid. A malmid is something that it makes the cheese stand. It actually gives structure to the cheese, and therefore its presence is felt, even if not tasted. You can see it. Without it, the cheese wouldn't be there. Afilu be'elef le'bottle, even 1 in 1,000, it's no good. V'davka shaloi hayasham malmid acher. But that's only if you only had treif rennet. Rakasur. Avalim hayazeg gam kein malmid heter. But if it's a mixture, it was a mixture of treifa rennet and kosher rennet, vegetarian rennet. Ze v'ze gorim. You have multiple causes. Umuta im ika shishim neged ha'isa. And then you can be, say, it's bottled the shishim. We're less strict when it comes to ze v'ze gorim. Ze v'ze gorim means there are multiple causes. Here in the case of the cheese, there is treif rennet and there's kosher rennet. And because we can say, well, it could have come from this, it could have come from that, we'll be a little bit more lenient. Can we say that with the whiskey? Can we say, look, maybe it's the wine taste, maybe it's the wood taste, maybe it's the combination. Is there a zerv zegorim argument? And I've brought you a number 11. I'm not going to read it all now because we don't have time to read everything. You can read that later on yourself. That is another possible argument to add in that people want to say, well, maybe halachically it's less problematic because of this principle. The real issue, however, which we need to deal with properly, is, okay, let's accept it. Let's surrender and say, you know something? The sherry taste is real trade taste. It's there. It's taste. It's not aroma. You can't just get away with it and it's not Ben Yomo. Can we at least say it's bottle? And we can forget all of the bad puns about taste, which is bottle in the bottles and all that kind of stuff. But batel in this case means it's nullified. Can we say it's batel? Well, how much do you need in order to nullify something? If you drop milk into your chicken soup, how much do you need? A 60th. Everybody knows it's a 60th. Usually speaking, and normally speaking, that's what you need. Is this true of wine as well? Normally we say less than a 60th, it's not there. Could we say something different about wine? Do we say the bittul b'shishim rule even for rabbinic prohibitions or only for Torah prohibitions? Even for rabbinic. If you drop milk in your chicken soup, which is a rabbinic prohibition, not a Torah prohibition, because on a Torah level chicken is parav, okay, on a rabbinic level it's fleishik, it doesn't matter. There still needs to be shishim, there still needs to be 60 times the amount of the soup to the milk in order to say it's okay. Are we going to say the same of wine? Well, not necessarily. Have a look, please, in number 12. Go over to page 5, and let's have a look at this. And this really is the main discussion on this particular topic. When it comes to wine, says the Torah in number 12, Yayin Nesech, non-kosher wine, wine made by non-Jews, Shenit Ariz B'mayim, which got mixed up in water, Asur B'notin Tam, if you can taste the wine, then that's no good. There's a mixture of wine and water, it's no good. Now, how much wine and how much water? Yesh mefarshim, there are those, says the Torah, that says, Dahainu b'shishim, Yutaka needs 60 like everything else, Kamo b'shar isurim, like with all other isurim. The Harivad Kasav, but the Harivad writes, Kaven shenit ariz b'mayim, that if you have water and wine mixed together, actually yesh bo yote mikidei meziga pog meziga, until it's more than a normal dilution, pogmo. Then it makes the wine makes the water worse. Umuta afilu b'shtir, and you can allow, so you're allowed even to drink it. What is that amount? Hilkach im yesh b'mayim sheish chalakim min hayayin, muta afilu b'shtir. Says the Torah, maybe when it comes to wine it's different. Maybe we don't need 60. Maybe 6 is good enough. Why? Why would there be a difference between wine and other things? So he suggests here the reason of the Rivet, which is that once you have more than one part, more than 6 parts water to one part wine, the wine doesn't improve the taste. It just makes the taste worse. Okay? There are other poskim in the Rishonim that give a different reason, which actually the reason that Rav Moshe Feinstein picks up on in a second, we'll see that, which is that actually once you have more than 6 parts water to 1 part wine, that's not even called wine anymore, which is an important point. And we see this in Hilchos Brachos as well. When you water down wine to a certain amount, once it's more than less than a sixth wine, then you can't even make a Brei Agafen on it. And therefore come along some of the Rishonim and say, yes, you've got taste there, but it ain't wine taste. It's now something the Gemara calls kihua. Kihua. Kihua just means like an acrid, acidic taste. And in fact, this position of a sixth is the position that Rav Moshe Feinstein takes in his tshuva. When he writes back to Rabbi Teitz and says to him that I'm not worried if they add in a 40th of wine into the whiskey in America. Ah, it's more than a 60th. Should be a problem. He says, no, says Rav Moshe. Because actually when it comes to wine, a 60th is not the relevant amount, it's a 6th. Because even if it adds taste, this is the chiddush of Rav Moshe, even if it adds taste, then I don't care if it adds taste, because that taste halakhically is kosher taste. Because even though it used to be trade for wine, once you've diluted it more than a certain amount, then that's not called wine taste anymore. And therefore even if they add it in to give it taste, says Rav Moshe, Loich Pakli, I don't mind, because halachically that's not wine anymore. Very interesting, that's where he writes back. So, coming back to our sherry casks, are we going to say a 6th or are we going to say a 60th? Now, if we say a 60th, we've got problems. Because it's very, very rare that a kli holds more than a 60 times the volume of the walls of the kli. Very, very rare. Okay? Therefore, if we have to say that we need 60 times the whiskey to the volume of the walls of the barrel, that's not going to work. But if we only need 6, then it might. We'll see if it does in a minute. And therefore, that's going to make a very big difference on which way we turn. So which way are we going to go on this? So the Shulchan Aruch seems to say, number 13, have a look in the Shulchan Aruch, Kama Yehei Mayim, the Yehei Bahem Kedei Levatel Tama Yahim, how much water do you need? Where does he decide on this issue of a sixth or a sixtieth. How much water do you need to nullify the wine? Shisha chalakim kenegda. Oh, six, not 60. Because yesh b'mayim kishira zeh, as long as you have that much water to the wine, mutar afilu b'shti, you can even drink it. He goes leniently, which sounds as though it's going to help us with our whiskey cast. We'll see if it does in a minute. He seems to go with six. The problem, the fly in the ointment, is, if you look at number 14, there's always on the one hand, on the other hand, number 14 says the Ramah, have a look here, kol elu mashkim asur liknot mehem, there are certain drinks you can't buy from non-Jews, she'anu choshishim she'ar'ir v'yayin, because we're worried that they might put wine in them, says the Ramah, ad she'ein shishim levatlo. He says there has to be a 60 times, there has to be 60 times the amount of the drink. So now we've got a problem, because now we've got two conflicting opinions in the Shulchan Aruch. One says a sixth, and one says a sixtieth. So the Ramah, who is Ashkenazi, we tend to follow the Ramah, Ashkenazim. So it might be therefore you conclude that Ashkenazim have got a problem with a sixtieth. How are you going to deal with that issue? So there is a machloket here between the Shach and the Taz. We haven't mentioned the Shach and the Taz yet. The Shach and the Taz were two very important poskim in the early 17th century, and they are the main commentators on the Shulchan Aruch. How do they resolve this difference between the 6th and the 60th people in the Shulchan Aruch? So the Shach says as follows. The Shach is Machmir, and the Shach says as follows. Actually, this is why there's a distinction. There's no machloket here. When it's wine in water, then we can be lenient for 1 in 6 because the water waters down the wine. But when it's wine in any other beverage, he says, you have to go with a 60th. That's the difference. So again, if that's the case, if that's the way we paskin, then that's going to be a problem for our whiskey. Comes along the Taz and says, no, we actually paskin down the line like the view that says 1/6, and the mention of the 60th view, that's an opinion that we don't follow in halacha. That's a machmir opinion, and la halacha we don't follow that. So you have a machlokas, the Shach and the Taz, when it's wine and whiskey, do we require a 6th or a 60th? Who are we going to paskin like? So most poskim, usually the machlokas between the Shach and the Taz, we paskin like the Shach. But on this particular issue, actually, most poskim, I've given you a lot of reference at the bottom there. You can look at it later. Most poskim go with the Taz and say, actually, we can be makel for a sixth. And therefore, it's not such an out-there cooler to say, it's not such a wild cooler to say we'll go with a sixth. So, where does that leave us? That leaves us trying to work out, is there more than six times the whiskey in the barrel to the wine taste in the sherry cask? Let's forget about 60, let's go with 6. Is there more than 6? Is there more than 6 times? Okay, so the next question we have to deal with is, okay, so how much sherry is in the walls of the barrel? And therefore, we go to source number 15. Have a look here. Source number 15. Afilu machnito v'lekiyum, enu bolea yotem iklikit. Says, even if you put wine into a barrel, non-kosher wine, it only goes in today klipa. What's a klipa? A very tiny shell. Lefikach im hevi alehem melaked veriti. What you need to do is you need to how do you kasher a barrel of wine used for non-kosher wine? He says you just take in a little bit of a scraper. There's a more technical word for it. Whatever, and you scrape off a level of the outside level of the barrel, and you're good to go, because the wine only penetrates to a klipah. And therefore, if that's the case, if we're only worried about a klipah of sherry taste in the barrel, then we're home and dry. We are absolutely no problem, because there is for sure more, maybe not so dry, but there is for sure more than six times the volume of whiskey to the klipah in the barrel. There is no problem with that at all. So that's his view. However, and there's always a however, isn't there? The Shach, again, the Shach comes in and he rules in number 16. He says, "Einu lebolei yotebide klipa." Why does it only penetrate a klipa? Near the hainu mistama amin and hachi mishum de einu yodeish nichbashayim betochel yom shalem. That's when we don't know that the non-kosher wine was in there for more than 24 hours. Avalim haya yodei yadua. But if we know, once we know that wine has been in the barrel for 24 hours, havele kavush, that's now kavush, that's called pickling, if you like, it's been soaked in there, ukfisha asu kol hakli. And therefore, as far as the shak is concerned, it's not just a klipa that the sherry taste would go into. We have to assume, since the wine has been in those barrels for many, many, many months in the sherry barrels, the wine has penetrated the entire thickness of the barrel. Oh. On this issue, the post can go with the shak on the whole. And therefore, we have to try and work out, do we have six times the whiskey to the entire thickness of the barrel? Now, you will turn around and say, well, of course, we must do. Surely we must do. The answer is, no, we might not. Have a look on page 6. I brought you a picture of a barrel, which will help you a great deal. But actually, there are people who have been doing measurements on this. And Rabbi Niehaus himself got a professional barrel measurer to measure the barrel, and he worked out that the internal dimensions of the barrel were 511 liters. They're around about 500 liter barrels. The external dimensions were 647 liters, which meant that actually there was a very large amount of wood in the barrel. There was 135 liters just made up of the thickness of the walls of the barrel, which is actually 26%, which is way over a sixth. You measure the outside and you measure the inside. You... No, no, because liter is a volume measurement. It's how much water it would displace. How much water does the outside displace, and how much is on the inside? So he realized actually these barrels are not like pots that you use in the kitchen with thin walls, stainless steel pots. They're very, very thick barrels. And if we go like the Shach, who says you have to assume that there is wine in the entire taste of the barrel, then we've got a problem. And this really is the reason why the people who are machmir are machmir. They say, look, if you say you need a 60th, then forget it. You're not going to get a 60th. Maybe even with the klipa, you're not going to get a 60th. If you say you need a 6th, then we still have the question, how much wine is in the barrel walls? Is it just a klipa, or is it the whole barrel? If it's the whole barrel that we were worried about, then we've got another problem here. And since it's not clear which way to go, on the klipa or the barrel, then people say, well, you have to be machmir on this. Interestingly, if you cut the barrels open, you can see that the wine staining goes through far more than a klipa, which people want to say, aha, you see, that proves it. It's not just a klipa, it goes through more into the barrel. Other people say, no, who says that that wine is relevant halachically? Maybe it's just color staining, yes. No, we're not going to take off the klipa. We're not going to remove the klipa. We're just worried how much sherry is in this barrel. We're not taking off anything. Is it just wine in the klipa, or is it wine in the whole sherry cask? We're for sure not going to start scraping the barrels out, because that would be scraping the barrel in many ways. And that we're not going to do. Let's move on, because there are other significant questions. One question that comes up is, okay, maybe that's a problem for the first fill, meaning they use these casks the first time. But what about the second fill and the third fill? They reuse and reuse and reuse these casks. By the time you get to the second fill, it's years, 12, 15, 16 years since the cask was last used for sherry. Think about this. They use it for sherry. They send it to Scotland. They fill it up with whiskey. So let's say, okay, we're not going to drink that whiskey, because that whiskey is halachically problematic. But 15 years later, when they've matured the first lot, they'll reuse the barrel for the second fill, and then for the third fill. Who can have a problem with the third fill, which is 35, 45 years later? The answer is, well, what about Chanan? What is Chanan? And I won't get into details, because otherwise it'll make our heads spin. I told you need a whiskey after this. Chanan works like this. If I drop a little bit of milk onto a piece of meat, I've got a piece of meat in a pot, and I drop a little bit of milk onto a piece of meat, let's say it's more than a 60th worth, so that piece of meat will become trace. Okay? That piece of meat is trace. Now that piece of meat slips into the pot and boils up with all the other meat in the pot. How am I now going to measure the whole pot? Do I take account of that little drop of original milk, which now is much less than a 60th, or do I say, well, no. Once that piece of meat became trace, that whole piece of meat is trace, and now it's that piece of meat that we're measuring against, not the original milk. And the answer is, it's the whole piece of meat. We go with the whole piece of meat. So are you going to turn around and say, well, that's very nice. The first fill, the whiskey, you traced up the whiskey with the sherry cask. Now the whiskey is trace. And now the whiskey itself traced up the barrels all over again. And therefore the second fill is no better than the first fill, and the third fill is no better than the second fill, because the whiskey itself becomes trace and it traced up the whole thing. And therefore that's a significant argument. There are people who want to say the contrary. I've brought you the arguments the other way. It may be that Hanan doesn't apply here. It only applies for meat and milk, or it only applies for solids, not liquids. And that is an issue as well. Then we come into the question of Bitl Issa L'Chadchila. Go on to page 3. Yes, sir.
We're talking about the difference between taste, which the sherry may give to the whiskey.
Yes.
And the prohibition of milk and meat.
No, good, good. So that's one answer. One answer might be that this issue of Hanan only applies with milk and meat. It doesn't apply with any other foods. But other posts can say no, it applies across the board. And if you made the whiskey trace, then the whiskey gives trace whiskey taste now into the barrel as well. And therefore the barrel's not going to be any better second time round or third time round. Let's look at a fascinating final issue on this before we get to some conclusions. Because so far I've given you a lot of reasons to be machmir and to not drink the whiskey. What about Bitl Issa L'Chadchila? Here's another very interesting question. If something drops into a pot of food by accident, okay, we can say it's bottle b'shishin. But if someone put it there on purpose, someone says, I don't care, just mix it in. Let's say someone comes along and purposely puts drops of milk into my chicken soup because they say, I think it's good for the soup, you know, and it's less than a 60th. You can't drink the soup. Why? Because, but it's bottle b'shishim. But that's only after the fact. If they purposely put it in, it's just called bitul issa l'chadchila, and you can't drink it. Are we going to turn around and say that I don't care if it's less than a 60th a clipper, even if you go with a 60th and a clipper, which will get you there? These people put that taste in on purpose. And therefore, if they put it there on purpose, maybe that's called bitul issa l'chadchila, and it won't help, even in 1,000 or 1,000,000. So the question is, why are the non-Jewish whiskey makers putting sherry taste in? So most of the poskim will say, look, if non-Jewish people are doing it for non-Jewish people, then no one's thinking bitul issa l'chadchila. It's not even relevant. They're clueless about bitul issa l'chadchila. And therefore many poskim will turn around and say, since the whiskey is made by non-Jews for non-Jews, then this is not a problem. The question is whiskey made, whiskey is definitely made by non-Jews, I can promise you that, but is it made for non-Jews, or is it also made for Jews? Meaning, does the Jewish whiskey drinking public actually figure in the mindset of the whiskey makers? And the answer is, it didn't used to, but it increasingly does. And I even brought you a link to an article from the Scotsman that talks about this issue. Ironically, the more that they're making it for Jews, the more problematic it gets, which is why you get the ironical situation that if you eventually give a hechsher to this whiskey, that makes it worse. Because the fact that you put a hechsher on the whiskey proves that they've got the Jewish market in mind, otherwise they wouldn't put a hechsher on the whiskey. So putting a hechsher on the whiskey, if you think it's problematic in the first place, actually ironically makes it worse, not better. Let's summarize so far. What is the story so far? The story so far is like this, because we need to summarize. We talked about a lot. The taste of the sherry that goes in the whiskey is good taste, not bad taste. I think we have to accept that. I don't think we can get away with saying it's aroma, it's not really taste. Let's surrender and say that it's good taste. Is it bottle or is it not bottle? So it's most poskim go with 1 in 6. That's perfectly reasonable. Rav Moshe goes with that. He says it's good to be machmir for 1 in 60, but 1 in 6 is acceptable. Okay? Let's go with 1 in 6. Are we going to go with the klipa, or are we going to go with the whole barrel? So that's not so clear. In order to get to drink the whiskey, you have to really be makel on quite a lot of different things. You have to say it's 1 in 6, not 1 in 60, and you have to say it's the klipa and not the whole barrel, and you have to say it's not bitul issa l'chadchila, etc. You have to be saying all of those things in order to be drinking the whiskey. Let me give you some grounds for leniency in case you're kind of starting to get hot under the collar thinking that you're going to have to go home and start rooting out your bottles of Lafroy. Let's have a look at some grounds for leniency and then we can reach some conclusions. This whole question is a question of an issa d'rabbono, not an issa d'oraisa. What is the normal meta-halachic principle when it comes to sofik issa d'rabbono? Sofik isn't Rabbonon, is Lekula, we go Mekel. And therefore, even if there are Machmir opinions, ultimately, This is a question on an issa d'rabbanan of sam yenam, an issa which most poskim say you're allowed to get benefit from even if you're allowed to drink, and therefore it's not ridiculous to turn around and say that we can be makel even on multiple issues when it comes to a suffix issa d'rabbanan. Then came around David Lichtenstein. David Lichtenstein, who is the writer of a book called Headlines. I gave you in the further reading an interesting article. He does a radio show in America. You can get it online. If you Google David Lichtenstein radio show, he interviews all these big poskim on interesting halachic issues. And he's apparently a fairly well-to-do man and decided to do an experiment. He bought 5 bottles of whiskey and sent them off to a lab for testing. And said, I want you to tell me how much sherry content is in these bottles. Give me a lab result. So look over the page on page 8 and see what happened. It came back like this. Glenmorangie, 12 years, which is a sherry cask whiskey, 0.06% wine content. The Balvenie, 0.0, less than 0.01, etc. He goes through Ochentoshan, Macallan, Glenfiddich, etc. These are minuscule ratios. These are tiny. The largest of them is not, forget about 1 in 6, 1 in 60, it's 1 in 769 is the largest ratio he could find in the sherry cask whiskey. And therefore he turns around and says, so you see for yourself, what's all the fuss about? There isn't any sherry taste in the whiskey. Forget about it. Now, one of the problems here is, sherry is not just wine content, it's alcohol that is part of that, and that doesn't show up in these lab results. So you can't just rely on a lab result for the sherry wine, the grape content, because the non-kosher sherry is more than just grape. It's the alcohol with that. So that's one question. But another interesting question is, can you rely on a lab result? I mean, is that what we do? If I sent my Fleischig pots to a lab and said, can you test the meat content of these pots? What do you think the lab would come back with? Very little, I would say, if any, and we'll talk about that in a subsequent shiur. Is that how we rule in halacha? Are we interested in what the lab says? Is there, and this is a much bigger question, which is fascinating hashkafically as well, is halacha a din, meaning it's a halachic reality that is given to us through tradition and masorah, or is it a metziyus? It is a reality in the sense that we can measure it, and that matters. Interestingly, there is a halacha about how to tell if there's a taste there, which seems to go a little bit to justify the lab result route. Have a look at number 17. If you have tray food gets mixed up in kosher food, it's one kind and a different kind, so it might taste something. Chalav, what does the Shulchan Aruch want you to do, ideally, if you drop a little bit of milk into your meat soup? Eat amunachri. Call a non-Jewish neighbor, call a non-Jewish taster, and ask him, taste this soup and tell me what it tastes like. And if he says to you, ooh, this is just like my mother's soup when she used to put milk in, it tastes fantastic, then you'll know, we've got a problem. And if he turns around and says, hey, it's nice, but it's not as good as my mother's soup, she used to put milk in and this doesn't have milk in, you know it's good. If the non-Jew says it's fine, there's no taste of milk, or she omer sheyesh bo tam ela shehu pagum, or it tastes of bad milk, mutar. Ve'im ein sham ovi kachavim, what if you don't have a local non-Jewish person to taste your soup? Mashiri mashishim, then you have to go with bittel mashishim. But ideally you ask a non-Jew. Comes along the Ramah and says, ve'ein noyim achshav lismach al ovi kachavim. We don't do this anymore. Who goes around to the neighbors with a bottle of, with a bowl of soup and say, just eat this and see what you think? We don't do this anymore. We don't taste based on a taste anymore. So you actually have an interesting machlokes between the Sfarim and the Ashkenazim. The Sfarim are prepared to rely on a non-Jewish taster. The Ashkenazim are not. They will only rely on a Jewish taster. What you can actually do, and of course you can't give the soup to a Jewish taster because it might be trafe and you can't give it to them. What the Ashkenazi could do is he could say to the Sfardi, you give it to a non-Jewish taster, and if he says it's alright, then you taste it, and if you say it's alright, then I'll eat it. That you could do, but that might make the Sfardi guy feel a little bit unhappy about being the piggy in the middle there. So do we rely on lab results or not? So the reason that the Ramah says not to rely on a non-Jewish taster is two have brought down the postgame. Number one, he might be antagonistic to the Jews and be giving you the wrong results on purpose. Or two, he might just not care. What difference does he make? He just makes something up. Neither of those reasons apply for a lab. The lab are not going to be anti-Semitic, and they're not going to be negligent. They're going to be very careful, and therefore it could be that the lab is relevant as well. Where does that leave us in a conclusion? In conclusion, there are many poskim that suggest stringency on the issue of sherikas. There really are, and I've mentioned a number of them before. However, there are many who are much more lenient and are happy to rely on the psak of Rav Moshe in what he said, although he wasn't talking about sherikas directly, and also the Minchas Yitzchak, we didn't mention, is an important psak. Rav Osher Weiss, who I mentioned in the footnote here, he has a very strong tshuva where he says that there's no problem with it whatsoever. Rav Osher Weiss is a very senior posek in Yerushalayim, and he says it's absolutely not problematic at all. And therefore, people who wish to be lenient and drink the sherikas whiskey definitely have on whom to rely, as they say. What is the policy of the OU? I feel we can only really mention that if we're sitting in the OU. I don't want to have an unfriendly letter from OU Central Office in America that I've said the wrong thing. The policy of the OU is that they do not permit sherikas whiskies to be served by any of their caterers or in any of their restaurants. And they take a fairly negative view. If you go on their website, they're not that happy about it. Neither is the London Based Inn, neither is the CRC, neither is Star K. They're all a bit down on the sherikas whiskey. Rav Herschel Schechter, will give him the final word. Rav Herschel Schechter of YU, he wrote a tshuva quite negative about sherikas whiskey. I actually have a copy of the tshuva at home if you're interested in it, and I actually created a slightly expanded version of the sheet which I'll put online when I put it online, and Rav Schechter was fairly negative, which made everyone in YU a little bit, well, he's very negative. However, the story goes, and I hear this in the name of Rav David Miller, who is the Rosh Hashiva there in Gruz, that Rav Schechter subsequently spoke to one of the chemists who works in the whiskey producing factories, who assured Rav Schechter that it was the wood, not the sherry, that they were looking for, and apparently Rav Schechter retracted that sack and he said, now I realize it's the wood, then that's less of a problem. So you can call Rav Schechter and ask him what his current opinion is on this, but either way, if you want to have a l'chaim, and come round to my house, I'll be more than happy to pour you one. Believe me, I don't think everyone can come, but if you come, you can find out what I'll pour you, and what's in my cupboard. Oh, I never thought of that. All right, so let's get to Simchas Torah, and then we'll see after Simchas Torah how that works. Let's leave it there. Complicated, but I think very interesting.
Just 1 second. Thank you. I just have to stop.